The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
In this episode, we are going to talk about the updated interim enforcement response plan for COVID-19 that OSHA has just put out. At the time of this recording, it hasn't gone live yet, but by the time you're hearing this, the old interim guidelines had been rescinded as of May 26, 2020. This new updated interim enforcement response plan will be in effect. So we're going to dive into that on this episode. Let's do it.
Welcome to the Safety Pro Podcast, powered by iReport Source, helping you manage safety one episode at a time. With the constant regulatory and workplace culture challenges businesses face, we'll provide you with all the relevant information necessary to achieve a safer, more productive workplace. No management theories, platitudes, or guru speak, just actionable info you can use right away. Now here's your host, the Safety Pro himself, Blaine Hoffman.
All right, welcome back to the Safety Pro Podcast. As mentioned, updated interim enforcement response plan for coronavirus disease 2019, also known as COVID-19. This just out from OSHA. Eliminating hazards from COVID-19 remains a top priority for OSHA. Because the government and also the private sector have taken rapid and evolving steps to slow the virus's spread, protect employees, and adapt to new ways of doing business. At this time, the rate of new cases, new hospitalizations, and deaths are slightly decreasing in many parts of the country. As workplaces reopen, OSHA will continue to ensure safe and healthy conditions for America's working men and women, pursuant to this new framework that they have put out. Essentially, there's two areas that they're going to look at. They're going to look at geographic areas where community spread has significantly decreased, and they're going to look at geographic areas that are experiencing either sustained elevated community transmission or a resurgence, a spike in community transmission of COVID-19. And so area directors will exercise their discretion in these areas. So in areas where the spread has significantly decreased, they will return to the inspection planning policy that OSHA relied on prior to the start of COVID-19. Now, they will still continue to prioritize COVID-19 cases that come their way, and they will utilize non-formal, phone-type investigations or rapid response investigations in circumstances where OSHA has historically performed such inspections, right, to address formal complaints, for example. And they'll do this when necessary to assure effective and efficient use of resources to address COVID-19-related events. All instances, regardless, right, the area director will ensure that the compliance safety and health officers, or CSHOs, they utilize appropriate precautions and PPE while performing inspections related to COVID-19, of course. Now, as I mentioned, in areas that are experiencing a lull, there's a decrease, they're going to use their discretion and they're going to continue to prioritize COVID-19 fatalities and imminent danger exposures for inspections. Particular attention for on-site inspections will be given to these high-risk workplaces. Now, high-risk is very specific. We'll get into what that means, the different risk categories that OSHA has set up in just a moment. But they're going to, again, use non-formal phone-type investigations instead of an on-site inspection in industries where doing so could address the relevant hazards, and also to ensure that the compliance officers utilize the appropriate PPE regardless, right? So just because there's a lull or a decrease in a certain geographic area doesn't mean that everything's all clear. They're still going to proceed with caution. So they have those two buckets that they're looking at right there. Geographic areas that are seeing a decrease and geographic areas that see a resurgence or sustained, rate of positive cases. They're going to kind of treat those two instances differently, and you could expect that. Okay, so let's get into what OSHA calls risk levels. This guidance really is provided to help identify risk levels in the workplace settings for the purpose of prioritizing OSHA enforcement, okay? So these enforcement activities during the COVID-19 pandemic are going to help you determine where you may fall in this category. These workplace risk levels are from the Occupational Risk Pyramid, described in an OSHA publication, Guidance on Preparing Workplaces for COVID-19. I will have a link to that publication here in the show notes. All right, so there are three levels. There's high and very high, right? There's medium and lower risk. So high, medium, low. Pretty straightforward. So what are they exactly? High and very high exposure risk jobs are those with high potential for exposure to known or suspected sources of COVID-19 that occur during specific medical, post-mortem, or laboratory procedures. Okay, so that's key. High and very high risk, medical, post-mortem, and laboratory procedures. Those are very high or high risk, okay? Workplaces considered to have job duties with high risks of exposure include, but are not limited to, hospitals treating suspected and confirmed cases, like patients, right? Nursing homes, emergency medical centers, emergency response facilities, settings where home care or hospice care are provided, and settings that handle human remains, biomedical laboratories. This includes clinical labs and medical transport companies. Now get this, aerosol-generating procedures in particular present a very high risk of exposure to workers. The aerosol-generating procedures for which engineering controls, administrative controls, and PPE are necessary include but aren't limited to bronchoscopy, sputum induction, nebulizer therapy, endotracheal intubation and extubation, open suctioning of airways, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and autopsies. So those would be, like if you're saying, how do I know if OSHA considers my company or my job to be high or very high exposure risk? That's it right there. Now, what about medium exposure risk jobs? Now, these are jobs that include those with frequent and or close contact within 6 feet of people who may be, but are not necessarily known to be, infected with COVID-19. Workers in this risk group, they may have frequent contact with travelers returning from international locations with widespread transmission of COVID-19. What about areas where there is ongoing community transmission? Workers in this category include, but are not limited to, those who have frequent and/or close contact with the general public or coworkers. Examples: schools, high population density work environments like meat and poultry processing, and some high volume retail settings, which explains why certain industrial sectors or retail sectors have been closed in many states. All right, that's medium exposure. Lower exposure risk jobs are those that do not require contact with people known to be or suspected of being infected with COVID-19, nor frequent close contact within 6 feet of the general public. They have minimal occupational contact with the public and other coworkers. So, if you're in a factory and it's just pretty much open to your employees and you're maintaining 6 feet, using masks, you know, things like that, you may fall into this lower exposure risk job. All right, complaints, referrals, and rapid response investigation. As the virus is spread now slows in certain areas of the country, in others it's not, states are taking steps to reopen their economies and workers are returning to their workplace. However, because of continuing concerns about COVID-19, OSHA should anticipate COVID-19 related complaints from non-essential industries. Up to this point, as you know, only what was deemed as essential industries and places of employment have been open. So those workplaces and employees have sort of, you know, been used to this by now. They know what this normal looks like in the workplace. They've gotten into a rhythm, a cadence, if you will, and it's familiar to them. Now you've got folks going back that were in non-essential roles. As those jobs start coming back online, they're coming in and it's all new to them. They're like, wait, I've got to wear this all day. I've got to do this all day. Well, what about these people coming in? And, you know, so OSHA's probably going to see an increase in complaints. I've talked about it in previous episodes. You have a grocery store worker that the employer requires them to wear a mask, but all the folks coming in shopping don't have to. You know, you're going to probably see a spike in complaints. So here's how OSHA is going to handle all of that. OSHA is expected to follow normal procedures in accordance with the field operations manual in those cases. Now, they may make only minor modifications as necessary, like requiring their compliance officers to wear masks. In most cases, fatalities, imminent danger reports, and life-critical unprogrammed activities will result in on-site inspections. Formal complaints, like, you know, complaints related to COVID-19 exposures in meat processing, which is the big thing right now, they may also be inspected on-site. And they're going to take this on a case-specific approach, right? So if case-specific facts or resource limitations constrain such investigations, they'll go to the phone or written response issue, right? So in high-risk workplaces or where a local area is experiencing either a sustained elevated community transmission or a resurgence in community transmission, area officers are to follow the modified procedures that we're going to go through right now. The modified procedures are a little different than before, right? So in the Field Operations Manual, Chapter 9, Complaint and Referral Processing, that's normally what OSHA would follow, okay? The general procedures there. Except that this response plan modifies that FOM, that Field Operations Manual, that FOM instruction, with the following quote: the employer is notified of the alleged hazard or violation by telephone, fax, email, or by letter, and by mandating an initial notification by phone to the employer, they have some additional modified procedures. So they've added, they have to reach out by phone, okay? So here are the following modified procedures. Fatalities and imminent danger exposures related to COVID-19 will be prioritized for inspections. And during the pandemic, formal complaints alleging unprotected exposures to COVID-19 for workers with a high or very high risk of transmission, such as a fatality that is potentially related to exposure to confirmed or suspected COVID-19 patients, while performing aerosol-generating procedures without adequate PPE in a hospital, should warrant an on-site or remote inspection. The area director should prioritize resources and consider all relevant factors, such as whether the complainant alleges inadequate PPE due to supply issues, in determining whether to perform a non-formal phone fax investigation instead of an on-site inspection. So that's key. They're going to use some discretion. So if a complaint comes in and says, we're waiting around here at work, we can't do certain procedures, I'm concerned, because they don't have enough masks. That right there could lead to a certain line of questioning of, hey, are you actually still requiring the high-risk procedures because you have a short supply of masks? Or have you halted those procedures and workers are still showing up to work, just not doing those things, but still have a shortage of masks? There's some discretion that is allowed to be used there. Now, where resources are insufficient to allow for an on-site inspection of a fatality or imminent danger event, the inspections for these types of reported events will be initiated remotely with an expectation that an on-site component will be performed if and when resources become available. We're talking about OSHA resources here. Where limitations on resources are such that neither an on-site or remote inspection is possible, OSHA will investigate these types of reported events using a rapid response investigation to identify any hazards, provide abatement assistance, and confirm that abatement. Right. So they're going to develop a program to conduct monitoring inspections from a randomized sampling of fatality or imminent danger cases where inspections were not conducted in accordance with normal procedures due to resource limitations. So they're going to rely on some historical data for this. All other formal complaints alleging COVID-19 exposure, where employees are engaged in medium or lower risk tasks, might not result in an on-site inspection at all, right? Depending on the discretion of the area director, where non-formal procedures can sufficiently address the alleged hazards. Inadequate responses to phone or fax investigations will be considered for an on-site inspection in accordance with the FOM, of course, and they will send letters out, and I have a sample attachment on these show notes here. So if you don't respond, that might trigger an on-site. Non-formal complaints and referrals related to COVID-19 exposures will be investigated using non-formal processing to expedite the employer's attention to alleged hazards. Also, employer-reported hospitalizations will be handled using the rapid response investigation in most cases. Area offices, they should be documenting the status and condition of work operations to the extent possible, noting any potential serious hazards, such as the type of process or condition of exposure that had been reported or that they learn about, and workers requesting inspections, complaining of COVID-19 exposure, or reporting illness may be covered under one or more whistleblower statutes, so employers need to keep that in mind. Finally, OSHA will forward complaint information deemed appropriate to federal partners with concurrent interests. Now, keep in mind, when it comes to injury illness records, we are in this category here with OSHA regarding COVID-19. Employers are responsible for recording cases of COVID-19 if all of the following requirements are met. All of the following, not one or two, all of them. One, the case is a confirmed case of COVID-19 as defined by the CDC. Two, the case is work related, defined by 29 CFR 1904.5, and the case involves one or more of the recording criteria set forth in 29 CFR 1904.7, example, you know, being medical treatment, days away from work, stuff like that. All right, it's important to note several types of facilities in the healthcare industry are partially exempt from the record-keeping requirements under Part 1904, right? And are therefore not expected to maintain the OSHA 300 logs. So you're going to have to educate yourself on those. Also, compliance officers should rely on interviews and other records reviewed during the investigation at those facilities. So when it comes to record keeping, it's very, very important that you understand that's where we are right now. All three of those have to be met. The one that folks get stuck on is work-related. If you're in this low-risk category and you're a factory worker maintaining 6 feet and you're working on an assembly line and you're wondering, hey, if I catch COVID-19, you know, if I come down with it or if I test positive, I may or may not be able to prove I got it from a coworker at work. Is that work-related? Well, remember the definition of work-relatedness. You must consider an injury or illness to be work-related if an event or exposure in the work environment either caused or contributed to the resulting condition or significantly aggravated a pre-existing injury or illness. Work-relatedness is presumed for injuries and illnesses resulting from events or exposure occurring in the work environment unless you meet one of the exceptions. And I'm going to run those down just in case we have forgotten or maybe we don't understand all of them. You are not required to record injuries or illnesses if, at the time of the injury or illness, the employee was present in the work environment as a member of the general public rather than an employee. If the injury or illness involves signs or symptoms that surface at work but result solely from a non-work-related event or exposure that occurs outside the work environment. The injury or illness results solely from voluntary participation in a wellness program or in a medical, fitness, or recreational activity like blood donation, physical exams, flu shots, exercise class, racquetball, baseball, stuff like that. The injury or illness is solely the result of an employee eating, drinking, or preparing food or drink for personal consumption, whether bought on the premises or brought in. For example, if the employee is injured by choking on a sandwich while in the employer's establishment, the case would not be considered work-related. However, if the employee is made ill by ingesting food contaminated by workplace contaminants like lead, something that's in the workplace, or gets food poisoning from food supplied by the employer, the case would be considered work-related. Also, you're not required to record if the injury or illness is solely the result of the employee doing personal tasks unrelated to their employment at the establishment outside the employee's assigned working hours. Or if the injury or illness is solely the result of personal grooming, self-medication for a non-work-related condition, or is intentionally self-inflicted. You don't have to record it if the injury or illness is caused by a motor vehicle accident and occurs on a company parking lot or company access road while the employee is commuting to or from work. You won't have to record if the illness is the common cold or flu. Note, contagious diseases such as TB, hepatitis A, or plague are considered work-related if the employee is infected at work. Or if the illness is a mental illness will not be considered work-related unless the employee voluntarily provides the employer with an opinion from a physician or other licensed healthcare provider with appropriate training and experience stating that the employee has a mental illness that is work-related. It's also very important to understand that for purposes of OSHA injury and illness record keeping, cases of COVID-19 are not considered a common cold or seasonal flu. The work-relatedness exception for the common cold or flu does not apply to these cases, so you have to keep that in mind. Note that OSHA had been exercising enforcement discretion for the recording of COVID-19 cases, given the nature of the disease and ubiquity of community spread, which initially made it difficult for some employers to determine whether a COVID-19 illness was indeed work-related, as transmission and prevention of infection have become better understood. Employers may be better able to identify where an employee's COVID-19 illness is likely work-related. Example, if the employee, while on the job, has frequent close contact with the general public in a locality with ongoing community transmission and there is no alternative explanation. And recently, OSHA provided update guidance for all employers to follow. Okay, so there's a memorandum, revised enforcement guidance for recording cases of 2019 coronavirus disease, COVID-19, on OSHA injury illness logs. It was issued May 19th, 2020, and I will have a link to that one as well. Because of the difficulty in determining work-relatedness, again, OSHA's exercising enforcement discretion to assess the employee's efforts in making work-related determinations. So this is key. They're going to assess how you, the employer, you know, what effort you took to make a work-related determination. And in determining whether an employer has complied with this obligation and made a reasonable determination of work-relatedness, the compliance officers will apply these considerations. I'm going to go through three main bullet points, the last one having some caveats to it. Okay, so one, the reasonableness of the employer's investigation into work-relatedness. Companies, especially small companies, should not be expected to undertake extensive medical inquiries given employee privacy concerns and most employers' lack of expertise in this area. It is sufficient in most circumstances for the employer, when it learns of an employee's COVID-19 illness, to one, ask the employee how they believe they contracted the COVID-19 illness. Two, while respecting employee privacy, discuss with the employee their work and out-of-work activities that may have led to the COVID-19 illness. And three, review company's work environment for potential exposure. Now, the review here should be informed by any other instances of workers in that environment contracting COVID-19. So the next thing they're going to look at, they're going to look at the evidence available to the employer, right? So the evidence that a COVID-19 illness was work-related should be considered based on the information reasonably available to the employer at the time it made its work-relatedness determination. If the employer later learns more information related to an employee's COVID-19 illness, then that information should be taken into account as well in determining whether an employer made a reasonable work-relatedness determination to begin with. So yeah, you may learn, just like in other injuries or illnesses, you may learn later on, oh wow, we've got new information that's relevant, and it changes the recordability status of this injury or illness. So keep that in mind. The third thing, the evidence that a COVID-19 illness was contracted at work. OSHA will look at that. They will take into account all reasonably available evidence in the manner described previously to determine whether an employer has complied with its recording obligation. This can't be reduced to a ready formula, but certain types of evidence may weigh in favor of or against work-relatedness. Here's some instances where this may come into play. COVID-19 illnesses are likely work-related when several cases developing among workers who are closely together and there is no alternative explanation. That last part is key, where there is no alternative explanation. They're seemingly unrelated events. An employee's COVID-19 illness is likely work-related if it is contracted shortly after lengthy close exposure to a particular customer or coworker who has a confirmed case and there is no alternative explanation. A case is likely work-related if their job duties include having frequent close exposure to the general public in a locality with ongoing community transmission and there is no alternative explanation. It is likely not work-related if they are the only worker to contract COVID-19 in their vicinity and their job duties do not include having frequent contact with the general public, regardless of the rate of community spread. A case is likely not work-related if they, outside the workplace, closely and frequently associate with somebody, like a family member, significant other, or close friends, who one, has COVID-19, or two, is not a coworker, and three, exposes the employee during the period in which the individual is likely infectious. I see that one all the time. That is the most common way that I have seen employees report COVID-19 cases from, my personal experience, but talking with colleagues and talking with others in my network where they have employees that report a positive case. It is almost always that one right there. There's almost always an explanation outside of work. There's always that last part, right? Where there is no alternative explanation. And it's not that there is a spread inside the workplace. There are employees that are reporting positive cases. They're otherwise unrelated in the workplace for the most part, but they have confirmed themselves, the workers, through these questions, in reporting the case, they've confirmed that, no, my husband has it. My neighbor has it. And, we hang out a lot or we've had these anecdotes or these testimonies, these evidence given, presented by the positive patient, the worker, that there is an alternative explanation. So the compliance officers are going to give due weight, right, to any evidence of causation pertaining to the employee's illness. And they'll issue a response accordingly. Now, if after the reasonable and good faith inquiry that I just described, the employer cannot determine whether it is more likely than not the exposure in the workplace played a causal role with respect to a particular case of COVID-19, the employer does not need to record that illness. In all events, it's important as a matter of worker health and safety as well as the public health for an employer to examine COVID-19 cases among workers and respond appropriately to protect workers, regardless of whether it is ultimately determined to be work-related. So you still have to do all of the things that we know will help prevent the spread of COVID-19. So don't let up on that stuff. I just ran down sort of the work relatedness. I talked about OSHA's response in this new environment of how they're going to choose to show up at your facility if they get a complaint and how they're going to handle those complaints. So look, check out the links in the show notes. You know, read up on this for yourself, because you may be in a situation where an employee asks, hey, you know, I was thinking of calling OSHA. I don't like how things are going. Or, you know, what if you do hear that somebody is calling OSHA? What can you expect from OSHA? One, are you in high, medium, or low risk category? That's going to be your first go-to. Two, what was the substance of the complaint? Okay, is it we're not providing PPE because there's a shortage? We're not providing PPE because we don't feel they need it? You know, go into that category. What's the nature of the complaint? And then we'll also look at your record keeping criteria. Make sure that you've covered your base there. Make sure that there is no other reasonable explanation or alternative explanation to the case, you know, before putting it on your log, and take a look at that. Let me know what you think. I look forward to reading your comments online. I'll post this on LinkedIn as I always do. And I also look forward to talking to you on the next Safety Pro Podcast episode.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Safety Pro Podcast, powered by iReport Source, the all-in-one digital safety solution. For info on how you can request a free demo on all the capabilities of iReport Source to streamline your business's safety management system, head over to thesafetypropodcast.com. We look forward to helping you manage safety on the next episode of the Safety Pro Podcast.